Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we want to continue our discussion here, finish up part three of our explanation of why Keynes's economics are not Keynesian economics. Keynesian economics is the bastardized version of Keynes and the economic analyses that preceded Keynes that Keynes criticized. In other words, what we know as mainstream economics, you know, macro 101, whatever, and the policies that flow from that, right, are not really Keynes. They are a cherry-picked version of Keynes, and where economists for the last 50, 60 years have picked from Keynes what wasn't really threatening to the system and integrated it with pre-Keynes that Keynes criticized. And that's how you got this bastardized hybrid version, which is not Keynes. It's Keynesian, and it's ideological. In other words, it's economic analysis that is largely designed to justify policies that have a lot to do with shifting income from wage earners to owners of capital, as well as justifying that shift to owners of capital. And the result, of course, is this massive income and wealth inequality that's been generated here since at least the 1970s, 80s. Not that it didn't occur before, but it's really accelerated under this new policy regime, sometimes called neoliberalism, that begins with Reagan, actually begins in the last years of Jimmy Carter, and has intensified, accelerated, expanded ever since. And the result has been this massive growing inequality of both income and wealth that we all know about. Okay, so Keynes, to recap the previous two shows where we talked about Keynes, Keynes said that one of the Achilles heels of capitalist economy is that it always drives towards inequality, inequality of income, inequality of wealth. It's inherent, it's endemic in the system that it will generate and accelerate inequality. And we talked about that in the first show here 2 weeks ago. The other thing that Keynes said in his last chapter is that capitalism also cannot solve full employment. The employment problem will chronically, structurally grow worse over time, over the long term. It may create jobs, but the number of unemployed will grow even faster than the ability to create jobs. And not only does it not solve the employment problem, it doesn't want to. So those two main findings of Keynes in his concluding chapter after his analysis in the general theory, written in 1935, are conveniently ignored by mainstream economics. They don't talk about that. They don't want to talk about that. Oh, there are some today in the last decade or so who have begun to talk about the income inequality and the wealth inequality, especially since 2000. You know, professors like Emmanuel Saez at Berkeley and a few others, I think his name is Gookman or something, those in the, who were trained by Saez at Berkeley, you know, have identified the income inequality and wealth inequality quantitatively, but they haven't given much of an explanation of why. You see, you talk about the problem, but you avoid any class analysis of the roots and the causes of the problem. You know, they talk about, well, the tax structure is favors a wealth and the wealthy. Well, true. But that's only the beginning of analysis. It doesn't really tell you fully why we have this chronic accelerating income inequality. And we know in recent years, just over the past year, you know, billionaires have increased during this crisis $1 trillion. Their wealth has risen $1 trillion, U.S. billionaires, you know, Bezos and Tesla and the others, right? $1 billion. Correction, $1 trillion. Trillion. Yeah, their wealth at the beginning of the crisis was $4 trillion, and they added $1 trillion over the past year, and they're adding more all the time, right? Income inequality. Well, how do they get such wealth gains? It's in financial markets, you see. That's where capitalism has transformed itself, financialized itself, because the profits are even sweeter and greater and faster in financial markets than they are in making things that require hiring people. That's the big transformation that I've been talking about in my books in capitalism in the 21st century, and it's accelerating. Okay, so to recap, two real radical propositions here in Keynes, income inequality, failure to produce employment, full employment. And don't be fooled by the numbers on job creation and job gains, because that's mostly statistics that show full-time employment. We have this chronic structural, even faster increase in part-time and temp jobs and gig jobs. That's unemployment because they're not really 40-hour-a-week jobs, you see. That's growing unemployment, hidden unemployment, and people dropping out of the labor force. That's unemployment. That doesn't get registered in the unemployment rates and the unemployment numbers very well or accurately, even if partly. And that's a big trend of capitalism globally, you see. It's changing. The labor markets are changing towards more part-time, temp, contingent, as they call it, gig, temp, whatever, kind of employment that pays quite poorly, by the way, with no benefits. Well, that's part of his Keynes's prediction. It can't satisfy full employment. Okay, and then in the second show, we talked about another prediction analysis of Keynes, which is quite radical, and that is trickle-down economics is not Keynesian. In fact, Keynes provided a deep analysis of why trickle-down does not lead to investment and recovery and growth, quite the opposite. Well, you know, Keynesian economics is associated with trickle-down. Trickle-down meaning, subsidize the capitalists, subsidize investors, subsidize businesses, and maybe they'll throw a few crumbs at the wage earners, and they'll get a little income on the bottom, and that will boost consumption and economic growth. And we talked about how Keynes had this big debate in his book with the straw man, Cecil Pigou, the most famous economist at the time of mainstream. And the main argument of mainstream, until Keynes came along, was that, you got to subsidize business, or you got to cut wages. If you cut wages, that will mean more disposable income in the hands of businesses. And if business has more disposable income, they will, it is assumed, invest it. And by investing it, they will expand production. That will require more hiring employment. That will generate more total wages for workers. That will lead to consumption. As Keynes pointed out, that's all ass backwards. Cutting wages, which economists were arguing about as necessary to get out of the Great Depression, cutting wages has the opposite effect. It reduces income and spending and consumption and GDP. And when that happens, people aren't buying the goods of business, so business doesn't expand. It doesn't invest. It won't increase production. Well, why should it? If no one has the money to buy the goods, why should it expand the goods? But, oh, businesses take the wage cuts, and they sit on them. They hoard them. Now, the same argument can be made about lowering interest rates. It's the same thing as cutting wages, because what it means is you're reducing business costs. The argument of let's reduce interest rates, and that will lead to investment and a stimulus of investing and, you know, the virtuous cycle of hiring and wages and so forth, right? Keynes spent several chapters debunking that, saying lowering interest rates has minimal effect, if any, on stimulating investment. Why is that? Well, it's just reducing a cost and increasing disposable income on the part of business. But once again, why would business want to borrow money, even if it's cheap or even if it's free, if to expand investment and production, if people aren't buying their goods? They're not dumb. They're not going to expand production if they can't sell what they got. Right. Oh, but the argument is reduce interest rates, and that will start the whole recovery process. Well, we saw historically, you know, what a false argument that really was in 2008 and 2009, right? The Federal Reserve reduced interest rates to zero. And in fact, ever since 2008 and 2009 in Europe, they've reduced interest rates even further than zero, negative interest rates. And businesses still didn't borrow. They still didn't invest. Even when money was free, they didn't invest because, Keynes argued, the decision to invest is not based upon the cost of investment. It's based upon what Keynes said was the expectations of investment and profitability. He called that prospective yield, you see. And expectations were very volatile and very sensitive. Investment is the decision in the present about returns in the future. And if you don't know what the future is going to bring, if it's uncertain, right, or if it looks like it's a depression or a contraction or a COVID-driven crisis, right? Business is not going to be optimistic enough to invest. So they're not going to invest. Even if the borrowing of money, the cost of money is zero, they're not going to invest. They're going to sit on it. But mainstream economics keeps telling us we got to give money, we got to subsidize businesses and corporations and investors first. That's what trickle down is, right? And they will do what they're supposed to do, and that will lead to a recovery. Well, that doesn't work. What Keynes said is that lowering of interest rates will lead to what he called a liquidity trap. In other words, business will simply sit on the money. They will borrow the money, and they will sit on the money. And hope to use it in the future when things might get better. But businesses won't make it better. You see, that's a fundamental finding of Keynes, and that is the collapse of investment, real investment, causes the collapse of the economy. But investment is not the road to start the recovery. The road to start the recovery is to give income into the hands of consumers. And to do that, the government needs to subsidize households and consumers, put money in their hands in order to prime the pump and start the recovery by spending, you see. But mainstream economics gives preference to subsidizing business, and so does monetary policy. The central bank that influences monetary policy reduces interest rates, right? And the argument is, well, that will start the recovery. Well, we saw in 2009-10, the failure of that. You see, Obama's whole strategy was to throw a little bit of fiscal spending out there, right? Most of it in tax cuts, which doesn't have an effect on stimulating investment in a crisis, and to get the Federal Reserve to bail out the banks and bail out businesses, which they did to the tune of $4 trillion. Zero interest rates for 5 years. Did we get a recovery? Not much. A bare recovery. Bare bones. Right? And actually had a stagnation, recovery relapsed several times under Obama to almost no growth, negative growth. In Europe and Japan, it was even worse. They had second and third dip recessions, you see. In the U.S., because it has the global currency and other economic empire advantages, was able to keep the relapse to a kind of a stagnant level. In other words, no growth instead of an actual double or triple dip. Actually, we did have a double dip in 2012-13 for a quarter or so, but that was covered up by redefining GDP, you see, that they did in 2013. Make it go away by redefining it in the U.S. But the recovery, the monetary policy-driven recovery, in other words, central banks, the Fed and the European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, Bank of England, and so forth, all did the same thing. It was a monetary policy, reduce interest rates as a way of jumpstarting the economy, and it didn't jumpstart. Right? Well, Keynes talked about that in 1936. You know, he said subsidizing business investment by reducing interest rates was not going to stimulate investment and recovery, right? It's like reducing wages, the Pigou argument, right? Reducing wages gives more disposable income to business and therefore starts the recovery logic and process, and Keynes debunked that. Well, reducing interest rates, the same problem. It simply reduces business costs. Doesn't mean it's going to lead to real investment, right? Real investment is driven by expectations, according to Keynes. Expectations of future profits in the short run, you know, 3 to 18 months ahead. That's what stimulates investment by business, all right? And you could say the same argument logically, by inference, for tax cuts, business tax cuts. It's the same thing. Reduce business costs, increase business disposable income, and that's supposed to lead to real investment, increase production, increase hiring, etc. Well, it doesn't do that either. So the three great policy vehicles, arguments of neoliberalism, Keynesian economics, in other words, simply don't work. They're all designed to subsidize business incomes, and they don't work. Right? Whether it's cutting wages, doesn't work. Whether it's reducing interest rates, barely works, if any. Not sufficient for recovery. And cutting taxes, doesn't work. Look, we've cut taxes $15 trillion on businesses and investors since 2001. What kind of growth have we got? And we have two great crises here. You know, we never really recovered from the 2008-09 Great Recession. At least wage earners didn't, right? And then on top of that, we get the second great effect of the COVID contraction, which isn't over, by the way, folks. So we've had two great recessions here. You know, I've from the beginning have said we're in a second great recession. And I'll be writing a book here or publishing a book before the end of the year called The Viral Economy, America's Second Great Recession, to show that this is another terrible crisis, economic crisis, that 21st century capitalism can't really deal with. But that's an aside. I don't want to get into the content of that book yet. Back to the point, subsidizing business incomes, whether through wage cuts or interest rate, zero interest rate cuts by monetary policy of the central bank, or tax cuts for corporations and investors does not lead to a sustained recovery. Oh, but business likes that because it puts more money in their coffers. Well, what do they do with all that money that they don't invest? They give it to their shareholders. That's what they do. Yeah, look at what's happened since 2010. Almost $1 trillion a year, $800 billion a year under Obama for 8 years of distributions by corporations, just the Fortune 500, by the way, corporations, almost $1 trillion a year under Obama every year, given to their shareholders in the form of stock buybacks and dividend payouts. And then under Trump, acceleration, $1.3 trillion a year for the first 3 years of Trump in stock buybacks and dividend payouts, right? $1.3 trillion distribution. Now, that fell back a little bit here during the crisis here of last year, 2020, but that will accelerate again back up to those levels, right? Huge transfer of income from the institutions of the rich, their corporations, right, to them, to the shareholders. Massive going on. Well, there's your income inequality. You hold wages down by various means, which we've talked about. You have stagnant wage growth, wage income. At the same time, you have this massive redistribution of income through the corporations to the shareholders. And what do the shareholders do with that income? I'll tell you what they do. They mostly invest it in financial asset markets, in stocks and bonds and derivatives and all the other securities that they have, that they speculate in. What's speculative investment? What is speculative financial investment? It is investment that is designed to drive or benefit from a financial asset price appreciation and then flip it, sell it, you see. You can do that with houses and real property too, but that pales against the stock speculation and bond speculation and derivative speculation, the speculation in foreign currencies and other sources here. That's been going on for the last 50 years and is accelerating every year. Massive financial assets. So all this subsidizing of businesses and corporations that's been, and the wealthy, by the way, you know, tax cuts for the wealthy directly allows them, the investors, to hold more disposable income. They don't pay as much taxes, right? Just like their corporations, same thing. You know, the tax cuts have always been subsidizing corporations' disposable income and tax cuts that's directly subsidize the wealthy individuals. You know, the corporate tax, the individual tax, income tax, no alternative minimum tax, inheritance tax cuts, and so forth, right? That all has been to allow the wealthy and their corporations to hold on to more of their wealth gains. And what do they do with those wealth gains? As I said, they plow it right back into financial asset markets and speculate. In other words, drive up the prices, rise the price appreciation in financial markets, and then flip it, sell it, big capital gains. And at the same time, you cut the capital gains tax so they keep more of it, you see? It's a game that's been going on, $15 trillion just since 2001 in the U.S. alone. Okay, well, Keynes talked about all that. And all of that, whether the tax cut for rich or their institutions, the corporations, or the central bank providing free money to the banks and corporations, which it has been doing since 2009, right? Free money, or tax cuts, right? Or hold down wages, cut wages by creating part-time temp jobs and so forth, gig jobs. All of that has depressed wage gains, which are less today in real terms than they were in 1982, right? At the same time, you have this massive acceleration of wealth and income subsidized by fiscal, tax, and monetary central bank policy going on. That's neoliberalism, you see? That's neoliberal policies. Well, Keynes predicted this, you see? He predicted this, and he argued, as I said, trickle-down doesn't work. Income inequality grows. You don't have full employment. Structural changes in the capitalist labor markets create less and less full, real, full-time jobs, more part-time gig jobs, and so forth. And lowering interest rates lead to a liquidity trap, which means they hold on to, they hoard their money, and they divert their money into financial asset markets. By the way, that diversion is global, because now capitalism and all its financial markets are totally globalized, totally linked electronically. And investors, capitalists, can move that money around wherever they want, instantaneously, globally. You know, technology has enabled this. Technology and deregulation has allowed it to happen. Move the money around, no more international capital controls, capital flow controls. Right? That was changed under Reagan. Deregulation and all that is designed to allow capitalist investors to move their money around to financial markets globally around the world. Oh, sometimes they invest in real, what we call real investment, real assets. I mean, you know, Elon Musk is investing, you know, in electric cars, and Bezos is investing in you know, distribution systems and so forth. I'm not saying that there's no real investment going on. What I'm saying is the relative weight of investment is increasingly financial asset investing. That's where the money is going, right? That's where the $1.3 trillion a year, just Fortune 500, you know, what about the Fortune 5,000 and all the other businesses, right? The money is flowing into financial assets, being hoarded, and or it's going offshore, either to financial markets or real markets, right? But it's not really being recommitted here in the U.S. in any major capacity. And that's why the economy is lagging, and why structurally you can't really get that much growth out of it anymore, except for service jobs. All right, so that was all Keynes's critique. That's all pretty radical, you know, when you think about it, and it certainly isn't Keynesian mainstream economics. But I want to elaborate on one more prediction here, an analysis of Keynes, and that's related to some of the comments I just made, comments that have to do with the financialization of capitalism, led by the U.S., to some extent the U.K., but the UK has pretty much faded here in recent years and doomed to be an economy kind of like Northern Italy, about the size of Northern Italy, but not the US economy. Okay, what is this other point, other argument of Keynes that's worth paying attention to? Because it has to do with the financialization of the economy and the instability, the capitalist global economy that financialization brings with it, right? This has to do with chapter 12 in Keynes's great general theory book, chapter 12. You know, Keynes, like most mainstream economists, were analyzing the real economy. In other words, the production of goods, real goods, employment levels, money, and so forth. You know, the things that economists are trained to look at. GDP, gross domestic product, what we call national income accounts, the variables there, the categories, are what we would call related to real investment. In other words, if you look at GDP accounts, what are they looking at? They're looking at investment in buildings, investment in equipment, even investment in software. They're looking at the inventories, looking at consumption of durable goods and non-durable goods, looking at exports and imports and government spending and so forth, right? That's the real economy, as we call it, not the financial side. But mainstream economists are never really taught about how the financial side of the economy really affects all this. And looking at interest rates is not the financial side of the economy. It's really part of the real economy because they consider interest rates to the extent that it stimulates a real investment, right? And Keynes, by the way, argued interest rates don't stimulate investment. It's changes in investment that stimulate interest rates. You know, what is the causal direction here? Same thing about savings and investment. It's not savings that generates investment. It's investment that generates savings. You know, that's how he's radically different than mainstream Keynesian economists. Contemporary economists are trained in what's called the national income account, GDP accounts. They look at those variables. They do not understand financial cycles very well. And that's why they couldn't predict what happened in 2008 and 2009, the financial-driven crash. Or they couldn't predict what happened with the dot-com crash in 2001, or the 1997 Asian currency meltdown, or what happened with the housing crash in the early 90s, or the banking crash in Europe in the early 90s, or in the 1980s and the residential housing collapse that occurred. Increasingly over time, we're seeing more intensified financial instability occurring in global capitalism, increasingly embracing not just local financial markets, but more and more global markets, more intense and larger than ever before. And that's going to continue. And that's due to the financialization of investment. More and more capitalists are investing in financial assets, speculating in financial assets. And that's what Keynes talked about in this chapter 12. The transformation of capitalist economy, giving increasing weight and a role to financial speculators. He talked about how over time we're seeing, as capitalism evolves, a greater role of investors who are not owners, who do not have a stake, direct stake and knowledge of the business itself. You know, they're not Elon Musk's. You know, or they're not Jeff Bezos. Increasingly, they're hedge funds, private equity firms, you know, all these professional investors. He saw a growing imbalance between financial speculation and the professional investors separated from the business who only cared about short-term profits, right? And getting as much short-term profit as they could. They don't care about building the business and growing the business, right? And of course, we see that today, don't we? In spades, more than ever before, that characterizes 21st century capitalism. Yes, there are some still, Warren Buffett's and the others who still invest in real things, right? But the weight of the total investment and capitalist finance class is growing towards the financial speculator, you know, the hedge fund guys and then, you know, the private equity guys and the asset management guys and so forth. Even at a lower level, the day traders, right? GameStop, AMC, right? Robinhood, all of this stuff going on. Increasingly, peer-to-peer investing, vulture capitalists, vulture investors, right? This group, what I call the new finance capital elite, is growing in number and in weight and influence over the economy, U.S. and global, and even the political system. You know, investment banks are part of what we call this group here called shadow banks, totally unregulated, by the way. They're not like commercial banks like J.P. Morgan, Chase, and some of the others. No, no, they are vehicles for the very wealthy to invest, often in financial assets, right? They are the vehicles for these investors, the professional capitalist, the professional investor, right? And this group is growing politically as well. Look, who ran the economic policy under Trump? It was investment bankers, shadow bankers, you know, Goldman Sachs. Who wrote the tax cut, the $4 trillion tax cut in December 2017 that was rammed through Congress that most of the Congress people never got even to read? Yeah, Mitch McConnell just drove it through. Right? Who wrote that? Right? Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, right? Gary Cohn, advisor, key advisor to Trump, economic advisor. Both of them, senior managers, presidents, and so forth, of Goldman Sachs. Yes, they wrote that tax cut, and they rammed it down the throat of elected, well, they, you know, the Republicans had control of both houses at the time, and they rammed it through, right? You know, it's interesting how they rammed through $4 trillion without any concern about bipartisanship. And now we got Biden who, you know, wants bipartisanship, right? And won't do a budget reconciliation to change the tax system and take some of that money back. Yeah. In other words, wimpy Democrats, wimpy Biden, you know, won't do what hardball Mitch McConnell did. Yeah. Tells you something, right? Well, I think what it tells you is that the corporate wing of the Democratic Party that really runs the Democrats, they too do not want to change that tax cut, that $4 trillion tax cut. You know, they're in lockstep with Mitch McConnell. Yeah. So both parties together, when it comes to tax cuts for the rich, they protect that. Oh, they may do a little token here and there, right? But nothing really major, nothing major. You know, I mean, Biden was going to raise the corporate tax rate from Trump's 21%, which he cut from 35%, back up to 28%. In other words, recall half of it. Ah, but Biden has already dropped it, right? And we're going to see the same thing go on with the inheritance tax, with taxes on the super wealthy individuals and so forth. Right, they protect those tax cuts for the rich. Make sure that continues. Right? Okay, so back to this chapter 12, which is kind of an aberration in Keynes's general theory. Kind of sticks out. You know, all of a sudden he's talking about real variables. You know, employment, jobs, consumption, etc. And then all of a sudden in chapter 12, he starts talking about finance. And the financial speculator, and this inherent trend in the evolution of capitalism that he saw back in the 1930s of professional investors being separated from what he called enterprise investors, right? Enterprise investment, meaning investing in real things, in production, making goods and services, right? That was enterprise investment, and the capitalist who are doing that have a stake in it. That's why they do it. Well, you know, look at your Bezos and look at your Musk. You know, they want to build something, right? It's part of their legacy, they think, or whatever, right? They want to build something that's never been built before. You know, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. You know, these are the enterprise investors, modern times. So they're still around. But the real investors that are growing, you know, the Schwartzmans and all the others, Elliott's, et cetera, on the financial asset side, right? Hedge funds, equity firms, et cetera, investment banks, right? They're growing even faster, you see. And they don't care. They don't care whether it creates jobs or whatever. They're just interested in short term. Let's invest quickly and flip our investment. Where can we flip our investment? Well, with financial assets, you can do it. These are highly liquid markets. Liquid meaning cashable. You can cash out real quick, right? Oh, if you invest in electric cars, or you invest in commercial space travel, or going to Mars or whatever, the Musks and the Bezos. That's longer term. That's more risky. The profit picture may not be as great, or certainly more uncertain. Your professional capitalist investors don't want to go there. Right? They want to make profits real quick, and they don't care how. Even destroying companies is okay with them. That's what private equity firms do. Okay. You got your enterprise investors that he talked about in Chapter 12, still here, but you got this professional investor, and that's really new, right? And most importantly, Keynes says that new factor, the separation of ownership and management, right, and the rise of the professional investor looking for short-term, let's flip capital gains, right, is a source of instability in the system, right? Instability. And it means the investment substitutes financial asset investment for investment in real entrepreneurial, making a real goods and services. That's the trend, to separate it out. Well, today, he saw that trend, warned about it in Chapter 12. Today, it's big time. It's big time. Since the beginning of the 21st century, and even before under neoliberalism, right? It's intensifying the instability of the system, right? Instability. And in chapter 12, Keynes describes this in interesting detail, right? As he says, in former times, investment depended on a sufficient supply of individuals of a temperament and constructive impulses who embarked on business as a way of life, not really relying on a precise calculation of prospective profits, right? But now we have men, quote, men who play a mixed game of skill and chance, right? And there is a quote, let me quote him again, a separation between ownership and management which prevails today, and with the development of organized investment markets, a new factor of great importance has entered, right, which sometimes adds greatly to the instability of the system. The separation of ownership and management is really a way of talking about the rise of the professional speculator and investor, financial investor, right? And that leads to an instability of the system. He actually predicted in that phrase of what's been happening, going on here since the 1990s at least, right? He talks about investment which is owned by persons who do not manage and have no special knowledge of the circumstances of the business in question. Yeah, they're professional. They want to speculate. The professional investor, he calls it that, who has a fetish for holding money capital, liquidity, right? Whose behavior is to beat the gun, as he says. End quote, as the Americans so well express it, to outwit the crowd and to pass the bad or depreciating values to the other fellow. In other words, I'm going to outsmart in the stock and financial markets other investors, and I'm going to get out. I'm going to make a big killing, and I'm going to get out before it crashes, right? Well, what we got today in the 21st century is the fiscal and monetary system chronically, constantly subsidizing these financial markets. So we don't get a correction. We don't get a contraction of financial markets. Why? Well, very simple. There's so much money being thrown at businesses, and especially the financial speculators, the shareholders, by the central bank monetary policy and by fiscal policy, tax cut policy, that they're awash in trillions of dollars of liquidity, of money capital, right? And they got to commit it somewhere. Right. Well, they committed to the stock markets, to the bond markets, to the derivative markets. You know, there's just this chronic subsidization going on with fiscal monetary policy keeps the professional investor awash in money capital, which he then throws into the pot. Right. The pot being stock markets globally now. Not just the U.S., because electronically I can move it from one market to the other instantaneously. Right. Yeah. And or if there's better opportunities offshore, you know, like subsidizing the real growth of China or some other third world emerging economy, they're going to do that, right? The returns are greater. They just send it offshore to financial markets or sometimes real investment. And the big financial markets in the U.S. and Europe, of course, right? Some other quotes about professional investment. Here's a quote, a famous metaphor, right, from chapter 12. Quote, this is Keynes. Professional investment, financial, may be likened to the newspaper competitions in which the competitors have to pick out the six prettiest faces from 100 photographs, the prize being awarded to the competitor whose choice most nearly corresponds to the average preferences of the competitors as a whole, so that each competitor has to pick not those faces which he himself finds prettiest, but those which he thinks likeliest to catch the fancy of other competitors. It is not a case of choosing those which, to the best of one's judgment, are really the prettiest. We have reached the third degree where we devote our intelligence to anticipating what average opinion expects the average opinion to be. That's the psychology of the professional investor in financial markets. You know, just translate this into what's been going on with day traders, flush with cash. These aren't mom and pop people, right? Flush with cash, pouring their money into competing with the hedge funds who are shorting stocks, you know, like AMC, the movie theater chain, or GameStop, worthless companies, right? And throwing money at that just to move the stock price, you know, just to throw the stock price up. They target, you know, those companies that have been shorted. In other words, investors who bet the price, the value of the company is going to fall. They throw their money against that wall and drive the price of that stock that's falling back up, and then they flip it and they make a huge capital gains. And then, of course, you know, they've cut the capital gains tax, so they make a huge profit, huge money profit. Professional financial speculator, right? And that metaphor kind of explains that. You know, that's where the day traders go here with AMC and GameStop and some of the others. Right? It's an indication of capitalism in its financial stage and growing the game of professional investment, right? A gambling instinct, he says, right? An investor who proposes to ignore real near-term market fluctuations needs more resources, right? But not these guys, right? By the way, they borrow a lot of the money, you know, the hedge funds and so forth, from the commercial banks like Bank of America and Wells and Chase and so forth. That's how, when they collapse, when a hedge fund collapses, it drags down the commercial banking system as well, right? He says, if I may be allowed to appropriate the term speculative for the activity of forecasting the psychology of the market. Okay. Americans are apt to be unduly interested in discovering what average opinion believes average opinion to be. And this national weakness finds its nemesis in the stock market. Mm. Okay, so, you know, that's a kind of radical analysis, financial analysis of capitalism here that he saw growing. Now, he made a prediction in the last chapter. These are rentier capitalists, right? Rentiers. Rentier in economics means to obtain rents from an economic activity means you're not really producing anything. You're manipulating the system to make income through that manipulation of the system. You're not really producing anything, producing real wealth. A rent is a return that's not been earned, right? Doesn't create anything. He called these rentier capitalists. Well, we're awash with rentier capitalists today. He predicted that the government and society would tame these people. Well, he was really wrong. He failed in that prediction. That was in his final chapter as well. The rentier capitalists are running amok everywhere, right? And appropriating all kinds of income and wealth for themselves by manipulating the system, right? That's chapter 12. That's chapter 12. Very interesting chapter. I talked about this in my 2010 book, chapter 2 and 3, which is called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, predicting that in the next decades or so, we're going to have another 1930s-like crisis, which will be precipitated by a financial crash. You know, the pretty serious financial crash in 2008-09. This crash, of course, the COVID crash, is not financial initiated, precipitated, but it's deep. The real economy has suffered even worse than the 2008-09 crash. And I'm predicting that if this is a great recession, it will lead eventually to a financial crisis here within the next 4 or 5 years. That's a prediction in my next book, The Viral Economy, America's Second Great Recession. So, you may have a financial crash precipitating a great recession, or you may have a great recession precipitating a financial crash. They're both related, you see. Financial markets and financial cycles and real cycles are more integrated than ever before in global capitalism, especially in U.S. capital. Mainstream economists just don't understand financial cycles and how they interact with real cycles, recessions, depressions. They don't understand that because they were never trained in financial analysis. They're trained in just looking at real variables, employment, investment, real investment, and construction and equipment and so forth. That's GDP. They're trained in that. And they don't understand finance, and they really don't understand how financial instability interacts with real business cycles called recessions and depressions and great recessions. Okay. In my 2016 book, called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, I talked about this trend towards financial investment and financial instability in a chapter. I think it was chapter 11 in it. And I predicted we have the rise of a new global finance capital elite, a new elite. And that elite, maybe a 250,000 of these investors who earn $25 million minimum a year from their wealth investment assets, right? And they have these proliferated financial asset investing markets globally around the world that they speculate in. And their preferred institutions, are the hedge funds, the new shadow banks, and so forth, not the commercial banks. This is what financialization is. This is what it is. It's this congruence of a new finance capital elite that has no country, moves their money around globally, enabled by technology and deregulation. They invest in these new liquid markets, financial asset markets, right? And they use these hedge funds or directly themselves. This is the financialization of capitalism. And as Keynes predicted, leads to growing instability, financial instability and instability of the system itself. Well, that's pretty damn radical, I think. But it's totally ignored by mainstream economics and Keynesian economics, who don't go there where financial cycle analysis is involved. Okay, I want to say in closing just something about the decision by the Supreme Court, which occurred here this week, further gutting voting rights. The Supreme Court's been doing this for a decade now, you know, chipping away at voting rights. At the same time, we have this acceleration of red state legislatures, Trump legislatures, further inhibiting voting rights, voter suppression going on, right? Made possible by gerrymandering so that the Trumpists gain control of these red state legislatures, right? The red state legislatures then gerrymander themselves into permanent dominance in these red states. And then they pass all these voter suppression laws. This whole cycle has been going on for a couple decades now. Right? And it's getting worse. And the Supreme Court supports it, right? And they help enables it, right? And that's why we're in a real crisis here come 2022-2024 of American democracy that is already in decline, serious decline. You know, now we see, you know, the truth of the Electoral College, which even itself can be got around almost there last December, right? Even the Electoral College, when it didn't work for them, they could go around it and they barely were blocked. January 6th, we saw all that going on, right? All the voter suppression going on, making it harder for people to vote, going on right now. Supreme Court, you know, in the whole process, Republican Party, you know, lockstep with the Supreme Court and these red state legislatures, real threat to democracy. The crisis has not passed. And I'm going to post on my blog, jackrasmus.com, the chapter from my latest book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, where I talked about how neoliberalism can't coexist with democracy and how democracy must and has been truncated more and more in the U.S. You know, we see what happened in December and what's happening now, but this is not new. There is a process that's been going on at least the last quarter century, since the early 1990s, where democracy has been targeted. The limited democracy we have, voting rights, has been targeted and is being rolled back in order to enable neoliberal politics and neoliberal economy to continue, right? It's political economy, right? You can't separate out the collapse of democracy in the U.S. From neoliberal economic policies. They are intricately linked, the attack on democracy continues. The Democrats do not appear capable of stopping it. That train has left the station. We are going to see the problem emerge even worse here after 2022 and in 2024. Enjoy the next 18 months, folks, because the crisis will erupt again on the political side and probably economic side at the same time. So I'm posting that chapter on my blog later today, jackrasmus.com. Go and read it. It talks about the step-by-step decline of democracy since 1990s up until Trump here. And of course, the last 6 months, it's accelerating even faster. Okay, that's it for today. I'm out of here. Next week, we'll talk about Marx and Marxist economics.